Bonjour tout le monde. Welcome to another edition of the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And by my side is our resident carjacker and general troublemaker, Mr. Gabe Haggard.
Hello.
Gabe, try not to shoot any cops while we're doing this recording.
I can't promise anything, but I'll do my best.
Okay, and Gabe, we've got to be on our toes today, because joining us is Mr. Kirk Honeycutt. Kirk, say hello to the listeners.
Hello.
Mr. Honeycutt was chief film critic for The Hollywood Reporter for many years. He's currently teaching several film studies classes at Chapman University, and he hosts the Sneak Preview series for UCLA Extension. And just to ensure that he has absolutely no free time on his hands, he's also writing a biography on John Hughes, which we will discuss later on in the program. It's truly an honor to have you here. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show.
Well, thank you.
Today's topics are as follows. According to the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless is the 13th greatest film of all time. Stay tuned to find out if our panel agrees with that assessment. Then we're going to switch gears. One might even go so far as to call it a jump cut. Maybe.
Tough crowd.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to get a sneak preview of Kirk's soon-to-be-published biography on John Hughes. Then we'll wrap things up with our final night of positivity. All right, gentlemen, fedoras on, cigarettes rolled. Let's do this thing. In 1960, a little film about a brash young car thief took the world by storm and ushered in the modern age of cinema. The film is Breathless, directed by Jean-Luc Godard from a story by François Truffaut. In previous shows, I've briefly mentioned the French New Wave, but we've mostly talked about films that influenced the New Wave or the Nouvelle Vague. But Breathless is, for better or for worse, the quintessential movie of this era and this style of filmmaking. I suppose we can debate that, but many consider it to be the quintessential New Wave film. It tells the story of a young Parisian man named Michel, played by Jean-Paul Belmondo, who occupies his time stealing cars and stealing hearts. All seems well in the life of Michel, until one day he murders a cop. What are you going to do? Now Michel's got to book it to Rome before the law catches up to him. But before he can leave, he's got to get paid for his latest heist, not to mention convince the cute American girl he's infatuated with, Patricia, played by Jean Seberg, to come with him. So, Gabe, we'll start with you. Do you like the movie?
In a way, yes, and in a way, no.
Okay.
I enjoyed the film. But I don't necessarily like what the film has spawned in terms of it being the quintessential or the first French New Wave film. There's a lot in it that I enjoyed. However, I don't really like what the fruits of it, sort of what came after it.
Okay, Kirk, how about you?
You don't like the French New Wave? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not a big fan of the French New Wave films.
Well, there was Chabrol and Truffaut and Godard and Rivette. And,
all of them.
God, everyone just out. Oops. Okay. Well, I mean, the French New Wave, I mean, what was refreshing about it and what I think was its legacy was it just turned cinema on its head. And it was, in fact, Susan Sontag, I think, called Godard the destroyer of cinema, where it took someone who knew everything about cinema to actually say, oh, let's just cut out the boring parts. Let's just do the things that we want to do. And so when you talk about a character like the Jean-Paul Belmondo character, you're talking about a character who is a fictional character from beginning to end. He exists only in terms of cinema. He is a bunch of gestures and cool notes from cinema heroes, most notably Bogart, whom he clearly is imitating since he stands in front of a poster of him and says, oh, Bogey, and he does all his Bogey mannerisms. And
right. So
the whole thing is on one hand, a movie in-joke where there's references beginning at the opening credits where it's dedicated to Monogram Studios, which was a B-studio. It was more like a C-studio in the Hollywood system. So it was just this compilation of these cliches of film, but turned on its head. And I always think of it as an accidental movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was one of those films that what Godard sent out to make is not what he ended up making, and it's very anomalous in his whole career. He never made a film like this again. And for your joke about the jump cut is apt, because this is the film that kind of brought us the jump cut. Mm-hmm. But that came about because he came in too long. He had to cut it. So he just took scissors to the damn thing.
Yeah.
He literally did. And he just cut out the stuff he thought he should. And, of course, now it's this herky-jerky motion that we think is, oh, how exciting. It wasn't what he planned.
Right.
It wasn't planned. So it was exigencies. It was just necessity being the mother of invention. And so he just came up with this. And I think it's an accidental film, but it had tremendous influence, as you were saying. But it, and I think it's a positive influence. But it,
you,
but it
you
had
mentioned
an influence.
The him being a master of film, or at least you know an avid student of film that had come before him.
Yes, they all were.
And I think that that's part of my concern in terms of going forward in film, because I see that. He himself was a master of film, and so then that almost gave—I think that almost gave him license to, you know, take the scissors to the film. Whereas people coming after him were merely looking at him, and copying his film, you know, his accidental film or his experimental film, and they were basing their film knowledge on his work or on these types of works that came from. "Quote unquote," you know, masters of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of have the right to and the license to, because you know it takes a true master to be able to, you know, to break the rules.
Yes, you know? He understood the rules and he broke them. Although this was his first film, the influence goes beyond just the style. I mean, if you think of the Belmondo character, and there's almost a through line from him to a lot of the characters played by Al Pacino, to be played by Warren Beatty and Bonnie and Clyde, certainly,
mm-hmm.
and to be played by maybe even Hoffman or some of the other actors that we have seen, De Niro. I think that's a direct through line. So I think the influences go along stylistic ones. I think he created a prototype of a hero or an anti-hero. And remember, Bogart was not a big deal in America in the 1960s. He had been dead a few years. His films were not, there was no such thing as revival houses. People weren't looking at the movies. That all came a little bit afterwards. When I was in college, we would have revival houses, and we'd go see Bogart double bills. And suddenly Bogart became the existential hero of the 60s and the 70s. But I think this predates that. And so he kind of, Godard is sort of reminding us of our own heritage when we look at this film, which is probably why the American audiences dug it so, because it was playing upon B-movie riffs. It was canonizing one of our heroes that we forgot about, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, its influences are greater than any of his other films.
If you had to describe the French New Wave, but to someone who had never heard of it before, what's the best way to summarize the ethos?
Well, it began, if you say, from 58 to 62 or 3, as a total revolt against the very studio-bound films of the French, the 40s and 50s. And it was a collective of filmmakers that had been spawned by the Cahiers du Cinéma, which was the official film magazine which all the critics wrote for. And many of these critics, at least, became directors in their own right. So they tried to follow through on what they were writing about, which was a complete rejection of the conventions of French cinema, and an adaptation of certain conventions they like in American cinema, but also bringing aboard certain aspects of shooting in the street and shooting with real people and all this that came from the neorealism movement, which was only a decade old at most, and some would say it was still going on. So they was trying to bring neorealistic elements and getting out of studios and shooting with natural lights and trying to take cameras, which usually were sitting on tripods, and trying to get them off those tripods, which in those days wasn't easy. They had no steady cams or the lightweight cameras or the Canon 5s or those things. It was very heavy, so they had to use wheelchairs to move around. They couldn't afford to put down tracks usually, and they didn't want to. They wanted to use wheelchairs, which they did in Breathless. They rented a wheelchair for the shoot. So they were trying to rediscover cinema by turning it on its head and going to the free flow of the early silent films, where you didn't have to worry so much about sound. You could maybe add the sound later. So it was an attempt to reinvent cinema in French terms, But it was really enjoyed by people all over the world, and it actually ended up having success, and these people went on to very long careers. So it was a breath of fresh air that kind of burst into the cinema at the time. In the early 60s, there was a time of stagnation all around the world, except maybe in Japan and a few places. So it was just suddenly there was something to galvanize film buffs around. This is really a great movement, and it continued for a long time, and it became something else. But for a while, New Wave was a way of, you know, reinventing, destroying cinema and as you reinvent cinema.
So the French New Wave, they have this reputation amongst maybe people who aren't interested in film as... And when we talk about this Sight and Sound list, we often criticize it or sort of jokingly criticize it for being just like there's this tyranny of the French, the boring French pretentious movie. But when I watch this film, it's not boring. It's certainly, it's very, very far from being boring. It's very entertaining. And so that really struck me. And I'm wondering, have we been terribly unfair to the French this whole time while we've been doing this?
I think so far in the list we've really enjoyed. I've really enjoyed most of the French films.
I know we've been. I feel like we've been very unfair. So, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, this film was directed by Godard, but it was written by François Truffaut, and many consider them the Lennon and McCartney of the French New Wave.
I like that. Have you ever heard of that?
Nice. Godard being the cynical Lennon figure, and Truffaut being the more sentimental McCartney. So,
but who's Ringo in all this?
Well, that's a great question.
Yeah,
Who is Ringo?
I don't know. Nobody wants to copy. Never mind.
So did you notice that there were more sentimental streaks in this film that aren't there in Godard's solo efforts?
Describe a sentimental moment.
Well, I mean, there was. Do you feel like the romance was he being cynical about the romance?
Who? Godard?
Godard,
or?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the character, certainly Belmondo's character has no reason to stick around, so he must have really had a yen for this girl.
Yeah.
So, and he certainly, it's the only girl he treats well in the whole movie, isn't it? I mean, he's not really treating anybody else well.
I think that might have been the one line, maybe even in the film, that you actually believe him when he's talking to his friend or his contact. He says, the worst part is that I love her.
Yeah,
that may have been, you know, one of the rare moments of actual, you know, honesty in the film for his character.
Well, sentiment certainly. I don't know if it's sentimental though. But describe sentimental.
That's true. Yeah. When I think of Godard, I think of removed, sort of ironic detachment. And did you feel that there were moments in this film where you could invest real feeling into the characters?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, even though she's kind of an archetype for the female American student abroad who's a little fascinated with bad Frenchmen, and he is in theory he should be a sociopath or some kind, but he never really is. As I say, to me he's just an amalgam of all these different movie gestures and behaviors and characteristics. So I take him as a construct, but nevertheless, Belmondo is such a oh, it's an overused word, but charismatic actor. He just seizes this movie, and he is the movie.
Exactly, yeah. I think he was known primarily as a comedic actor in France, and I think that...
I think it was this film that put him on the map.
Right,
oh, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Sans doute.
Yeah. Yeah, and he absolutely carries the film, and I feel like that Michel character is such a great metaphor for the entire ethos of the movement. It's sort of... It is, as you said, it is an amalgam of lots of different characters of all of the influences. And I love how they put him in, like, oversized clothing, and the cigarette is a little bit, is too big. It makes him look small. So it kind of makes him look like a kid playing dress-up. And
might have been the style of that era.
That could have been that too. But there's something about just a kid like trying on the big boy clothes for the first time, and that struck me as some kind of what Godard was doing.
Well, I think that's an apt analogy to like a small child, because the long scene in her bedroom, it sort of reminded me of two children. Mm-hmm. You know, talking to each other and playing with each other, and he's saying, not I hate you, but he's saying like you disgust me, you know, and then you know, and he just wants to sleep with her. And, you know, it's going back and forth, almost the way the two children on a playground might, you know, be
falling in love. It ends a little differently.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't... To me, she always seemed to have a pretty good handle on the situation, though. He always seemed so young and so immature. And the way that he was just, like, begging for sex, which is a part of why it was hard for me to invest emotionally in this film, because all of his posturing, while I found it really funny, it was hard for me to believe that she would reciprocate any of his feelings. And that's why I wanted to bring up her character, Patricia. What is her motivation? When I watched this film, she seemed so cold. I wasn't sure where she was coming from exactly.
I'm not sure that Gene Seberg was the best casting idea, but it did probably help sell the movie and get the producer to on board. And I don't know if she would come off a couple of Otto Preminger movies.
Right.
Which were not well received, and so she wasn't any critic's darling for sure. And I'm not sure how good an actress she was at this point in her career. Mm. So that might be a lot of your reservations, the fact that she barely holds a screen with him except for her radiant usefulness and vigor and you know, and walking down the street in that iconic moment selling the Herald Tribune. I agree. She is a bundle of contradictions, if nothing else. On one hand, she's a very independent person, and yet she seems to be very dependent upon men, even though she says she's not, but she is. She seems to actually, she says she loves him at one point, I think, at the end, and yet she still spends the night with an editor in order to get her interview. So, I mean, all these things, it is contradictory, and there's no, I don't think there's any underlying psychology that we can get into.
So, I mean, you mentioned the filming techniques. They also, for the most part, it is like a Dogma film in that they use primarily natural lighting.
Dogma is just doing Breathless.
Yeah.
And no stars, because these weren't stars in those days.
So how has Godard's style changed over the years? This is sort of a one-off Breathless.
It really is. And the problem with talking about Godard sitting here in sunny Southern California is, when do you get to see any of his films? There may be some way on the internet to download certain things. And a lot of his films aren't what we consider films. They're video experiments that last half an hour. He sits in, I think it's somewhere near Geneva in Switzerland. He's actually a Swiss citizen. So it's really the Swiss New Wave. No, he was definitely French, and he was born in Paris. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that. But and he makes these odd films, and every now and then one actually does get introduced into the Cannes Film Festival, and sometimes they play festival circuit here. I asked him, do you think any of the French New Wave directors fulfilled their promise? And he said, me, maybe. And I don't think he's just perfectly serious. He was giving what he thought was a very honest answer. He said,
wow.
No, me maybe. Cinema.
Right. That's a very strange thing for him to say, because I feel like most of the filmmakers have fulfilled their promise. Most of the most famous ones, anyway, have made lots of great films.
One shouldn't take him too seriously. I don't know how seriously he takes himself, but he's kind of the enfant terrible of the French cinema, and I think he's sort of fun in that regard, and I don't know if he realizes it, but he is a ferociously intelligent man when you speak to him. I mean, it was the things he would say would be the kind of things you'd want to hear in a lecture hall from your film professor, just to electrify you and with thoughts and ideas that may or may not pay off when you're on a movie set. But I mean, just the idea of these things, because he really wants to get to the bottom of what is cinema, what are images, and the only way he can do it is by making these films that are very hard on some viewers trying to understand what he's trying to do. But over time, you get it. And I remember seeing once years and years and years ago a film from the Philippines. Not when in those days films didn't come from the Philippines. And you look at this film, and 10 minutes into it, you say, Godard. The guy's doing Godard. And so he really touched a chord with people who are cinema people who really live and breathe film. It showed how you could do a films in a different sort of way. For one semester, I taught some world cinema, And you look at these films back in the 20s and the 30s, and the thing about them, they're not conventional films by today's standards, especially the French ones. They could be 60 minutes, 50 minutes. They could do all kinds of crazy things with cameras. They were doing all kinds of unconventional things, especially in France. And so if they were looking at their own films, they're going, where did we get these well-upholstered studio centric films where you're on sets and there's these costumes from the 18th century, and what is this? Why aren't we out in the streets filming, you know, what's going on today? But they got that, I think, by looking at their films from the 20s, because the poetic realism, which is what it gets labeled now in colleges, the poetic realism of the 20s cinema is just really amazing, because it's not like movies that we're used to seeing. And students today look at this and they don't know what they're seeing. They just go, oh, it's old. And they said, no, actually, it's pretty new. And that's the thing. It's probably newer than what you're looking at today when you go see a Marvel Comics movie.
Right.
That's what's so incredible about going through this list and watching all these old movies. I haven't ever seen these films before, yet I feel like it's new and old at the same time. Like, these films and the techniques, like in L'Atelon, like, it's just amazing. It's so cool to see. They're doing things, like you said, that you're not seeing, that I'm not seeing in the movie theaters. I think maybe you can make a parallel to Man with a Movie Camera.
Mm-hmm.
And in our discussions, we talked about how Man with a Movie Camera really felt like a kid with a new toy.
Oh, it was.
Yeah. And I think that this film, you could say, is similar to that. And they're like, you know, they're discovering this thing, film, and looking for, you know, new and different ways to approach it and to look at it. It doesn't have to be on the tripod, you know, all that kind of stuff.
And also the narrative. The narrative. We've been talking about why the narrative seems weird to us in this film and in other films. Fracturing narrative and trying putting it back together in different ways, unlike, you know, the Robert McKee school of writing, where you have to have your mid-act climax here and all these bloody rules that will maybe sell a film or two if you're trying to write a screenplay, but it ossifies things. And right now we need a breath of fresh air in our cinema, because right now we have studio people who can only make $100 million movies. They have thrown out the $30 and $20 million movies completely. Every now and then they'll pick up a very low budget film and try a hand with that on their classics division or something. But right now American cinema's in the doldrums, and we need a new wave.
All right, well, I guess we need to put out a call for the next Godard, the 21st century. Or maybe Godard is, you know, he's still making films, so.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be able to bring him into the executive suites at Universal and get him a deal right now.
Get him a meeting.
Yeah, three-pick deal, right. Oh, yeah, that'll happen.
So I'm going to, let's go to the final question. Do you think that Breathless deserves its spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll? Number 13, lucky 13. Gabe, what do you think?
I think maybe in the sense that it is incredibly influential to all of cinema that's come after it. I don't think I would put it on a personal list that high, because I don't really like a lot of the consequences of it. But I think in terms of, like, its far-reaching scope and influence on modern cinema, I think they have every right to put it at number 13.
All right, Kirk, how about you?
Well, I agree with what Gabe said. I'm not as upset about the consequences of films. And you can't put that to the film itself anyway. Yes, for the influences alone, it belongs there. But certainly it's a quite an entertaining film, and I think I can show this to my students or a bunch of grandmothers or whatever, and they will all kind of get into it to some degree. I think it's the most accessible film he ever made, obviously. And it plays so well that it I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be somewhere in that upper echelon of films. But by influence alone, it belongs there.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's no denying the impact this film made when it was released. And I think the effects of it still reverberate to this day. We still have people citing Jean-Luc Godard as an influence and Breathless as an influence. And when you watch the film, when I watch the film, I still think it's funny. I think that it has this great energy. and it's got this boldness, this brashness that I really respond to. I think the part of me that really loves punk rock music really responds to this film. So because of that, I absolutely do think it deserves to be number 13, possibly even higher. So how about that? Another band of crazy kids. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Kirk is currently writing a biography of the chronicler of American teenage life in the 1980s, John Hughes. Hughes is probably best known for writing, directing, and producing The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, and Ferris Bueller. And since we always like to take advantage of any expertise that comes our way, we're going to pick Kirk's brain about what made John Hughes such an iconic and enduring voice. So, Kirk, what inspired you to write this book on John Hughes?
Someone gave me a contract.
Yeah.
No, it was their idea, but it also just raises a question suddenly. Why? I mean, why did John Hughes suddenly have this grip on comedy in the 80s to the degree that nobody ever has and had the staying power and the longevity that no one has? Because if you look at Preston Sturges, it was a very skyrocketing thing, and then it would kind of plummeted to earth rather quickly. There's very few comedy writer-directors I can think of, I'm trying to think of any, who just stayed the course for so many years that were just primarily dealing with comedy. And the critics didn't pay a lot of attention to them. It was just, well, a John Hughes movie was coming out seemingly every other weekend, and so you reviewed it, usually giving it, you know, passing middling, fair to middling notices, and you just moved on. And then year after year, it kept going and going and going, and some of them weren't even that good. And you wondered what was the secret here. And then he just vanished. So what was that all about? Who was that masked man? I mean, really, who was that masked man? So, I mean, that does raise a very interesting question. How was he so popular, even though he wasn't popular in Hollywood as a human being because he was very difficult? But how did he get studios to just keep giving him money to make movies? And so that was an interesting question that I'm trying to solve as I write.
So are you a fan of his work?
I wasn't at the time I was approached. In fact, I went back and read some of my reviews, and I have to admit they weren't all these that laudatory. And I also caught, admittedly, the end of his creative spree when he was doing things like Dutch and doing things like Curly Sue and doing, you know, making movies that weren't very successful. And he knew that, and by his own standards, he knew that.
So why don't we start from the beginning? What inspired John Hughes to become a filmmaker?
Well, he was a storyteller all his life. He just wrote and wrote and wrote. He was always writing. He was writing jokes for comics. He was writing. I uncovered the fact, and believe it or not, in my own interview with him once, when I was doing a thing about him doing at one time he signed a deal to do the Peanuts movie. He said to me, "Oh, you know, well, my first paying job as a writer was when this guy had a stroke who was doing a comic strip." And they asked me to, his daughter asked me to ghost it for a while. And so it was kind of fun, but I couldn't draw. So I was just taking old drawings and rewriting the dialogue in them. And of course, that didn't last long, but it was kind of fun. And I have a thing about comic strips. So he was always writing, but he got a job in advertising. He was a copywriter in Chicago, Leo Burnham. And he handled a lot of the major accounts, Virginia Slims and so forth. And he was rose very high in the hierarchy. By the time he was in his 20s, he was a creative director, and he was one of the top guys at Leo Burnham. And he had all these major accounts. And he was flying to New York quite frequently to service, actually, the Virginia Slims account. And he happened to notice that that's where the headquarters was for his favorite magazine, which was National Lampoon. So he kept walking in the door and introducing himself to people, and he finally got their attention, and he started sending in stories and all kinds of things, and they started using them, and pretty soon P.J. O'Rourke, who became editor, managing editor, whatever, he became the boss. He said, "Why don't you come aboard full-time here?" And he said, "Sure." But what he did was, he said, "But I'm not leaving Chicago." They said, "Well, you don't have to. Just send in the copy. Come in here once a week for, you know, the meetings and so forth." So he never quit the agency. He kept two jobs. He would just go into the office, have a cup of coffee, put it down, throw his coat over the chair, go out to O'Hare, catch the shuttle to New York, drive in from LaGuardia across the bridge into Madison Avenue where was the headquarters of National Lampoon, take his meeting, get a cab, go back to the airport, get back to office and say, well, what's happened? And people would wonder. And then at the end of the day, he'd put coffee grounds and things in the, and he would just act like he'd been there all day and someone had never noticed, where was John? You know, so he was doing this. And finally, there was a big blizzard in Chicago, huge blizzard, and he couldn't go to work. And he stayed home and he wrote Vacation 58, which was the story that actually became Vacation, the movie with Chevy Chase. But he wrote this thing, and he had so much fun staying home and writing this. He says, you know something? I don't want to be 65 and say, oh, I should have, could have, would have done it. I want to just see if I can make it as a writer. So he quit. And he full-time at the National Lampoon. Not moving to New York, by the way. He still stayed in Chicago, but full-time. And in those days, the National Lampoon became a place for screenwriting because a thing called National Lampoon's Animal House. And it was a huge hit. So suddenly everybody wanted a National Lampoon movie. So everybody there became screenwriters. And John Hughes was one of them. He tried writing a bunch of stuff. Finally, he wrote not a very good script called Class Reunion. And he went to Matty Simons, who ran the place, and said, would you like to make this movie? And Matty read the script and said, that's not very good. He says, well, Matty, I really want to get it made. I don't really want to produce it. And he said, well, can I say it's National Lampoon on it? Can I put the National Lampoon name on it? Well, John, I don't know. Well, come on, Matty, it's me. Come on, it's John. Come on. He said, all right. So it got made, and it nearly killed the National Lampoon franchise. It was so bad. But by this time, Matty had him working on screenplays, and one of them, he said, you know, that movie, that story you wrote, Vacation 58, about these people taking a vacation to Disneyland in 1958, where Dad ends up shooting Walt Disney. That would make a good movie. Well, they had to take that part out, of course. They made it Wally World. And so that movie was a huge hit. He wrote that movie. Harold Ramis directed it. It still holds up today. I can tell you it's still a great film. He did a really good job. And then he had the same year he came out with another hit, not a film that holds up well, Mr. Mom, with Terry Garr and Michael Keaton. But it was a hit. I mean, a very big hit. So he now had the ability to say, okay, on my next script, I direct it. So 16 Candles was his debut film. And 16 Candles is a real studio film. You know, it's shot in various locations. It has a large cast. And when he was on the set, he was saying to his producer, God, this is so weird. She said, what? As Michelle Manning was her name. He said, well, I always had envisioned my first film would be this little bitty film I wanted to make. And instead, here I'm, you know, we got several moves a day. We got Teamsters. We got trucks going around. And I'm having to manage this entire production. It's this little bitty film for $1 million that I want to make next. And she said, John, you don't go from a $10 million movie to a $1 million movie if you have any career sense. Let me read the script. Breakfast Club, it was called. And, of course, it became the iconic film we know it to be. Surprisingly enough, not a huge box office film. It did well. Everyone thinks it's been this huge success, and it is only over years as people used to rent it as DVDs, just slowly built its audience serially until nowadays. That's the first movie you think of when you think of John Hughes, even though it, like Breathless and Godard, is almost anomalous. It's a very atypical film for him. It's not the kind of film he made after that or even before that. Mm. But he had a lot of hits.
And what were some of his significant cinematic influences?
I don't know that he had any. He didn't seem to go to a lot of movies himself. I think he saw movies. I know he liked Hitchcock. I know he liked Chaplin. I found out something curious that he, in an old interview, and I have to trust that it's accurate, that he saw Blow Up like 23 times when he was in school. But
interesting.
Well, yeah, he said, I think I mostly went to the scene with the two girls with naked tits and with David Hemming. And I just thought, well, that was kind of funny. And then I realized, you'll have to read the book, there's a scene in Blow Up, I think he steals for Ferris Bueller. I think there is a scene in Ferris Bueller that shows he saw it blow up 23 times.
Interesting.
Yes, you'll have to read the book. Antonioni was an influence.
That is interesting.
You didn't think I would say that, did
you? See that one coming.
No. No, I mean, I think he looked at all kinds of movies. But given where he was working in comedies, and comedies that were either family comedies or teen comedies, there were no influences because he didn't like the Porky's and those kinds of Fast Times at Ridgemont. He wasn't really fond of those films. He felt those were films that were made for older guys who like to think they were teenagers.
Personally, when I think of John Hughes, I think teen movie. He makes teen movies. So is that a fair summation of his work?
Well, if you looked at the films, you'd probably find it kind of stops after a while. It's a fair summation into the late 80s. And then he discovered in John Candy somebody who he was so simpatico with that he kept writing roles for him. They made three movies almost back to back. And then Candy also, as a thank you, appeared in two other films of his, Home Alone and Career Opportunities, as cameos, one-day shoots. But he found an adult star who could play not so much childlike characters, but characters that never wanted to grow up, which is a bit like John Hughes was, too. There's this Peter Pan complex in both of them. So they made a bunch of films, and I think Trains, Planes, and Automobiles might possibly be John Hughes' best all-in-all film. And that's a film that doesn't star any teenagers. It stars Steve Martin and John Candy.
Right.
And he started drifting in that way, but he made a film that was the key film of his career in terms of how he changed his course. He made a film called She's Having a Baby, where he was writing about himself and his wife. How a guy who gets married too early, he was about 20, he married his high school sweetheart. They immediately had cute kids. But that is the movie. He wrote an autobiographical movie. You could say all his movies are autobiographical, but he wrote one that was pure autobiography. It's even dedicated to Nancy, his wife. So he wrote that, and it went out and bombed, made $16 million. He was used to making $40, $50 million. That shook him. He says, okay, no more me. So he started making anti-comedies like Home Alone. He started making some iconic films. You take remake Disney movies, 101 Dalmatians. You start looking at Peanuts maybe or Dennis the Menace. You start doing younger and younger children. Baby's Day Out was a toddler. You start making family films. He became a movie-making factory. He moved into that and was very successful. His biggest payday ever was 101 Dalmatians because he had the merchandising rights on that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was not unsuccessful. He was actually more successful than ever, but he wasn't making personal kinds of films that you think of when you say teenage, when you think of Breakfast Club, when you think of Ferris Bueller or 16 Candles. Those are the films, and maybe I watched on TV last night, Weird Science.
People still hold such affection for those films. The Ferris Bueller's, the 16 Candles, the Pretty in Pink's, even though he didn't direct that one.
Yeah,
people
but he
still
did,
love
but see
them.
Something about those early films, when he was a young, eager writer, he wrote from the heart in a way he wasn't able to fully do, because I do like Home Alone, but fully do when he started doing 101 Dalmatians with Glenn Close.
Mm-hmm.
And you think it was the failure of that one film?
I do.
When
you see a right hand turn in someone's career and that's the film and that film bombs and it was autobiographical, yeah, I do. I mean, other people have said this to me, but I do too.
So in the 80s, why do you think teenagers connected so wholeheartedly to these films?
Oh, he wrote directly for them and they could tell. He was not talking down to them. He was not putting in all those little jokes for the 30-year-old men. He was talking directly to the things that bug them, because you understand if a girl can't get a date for the prom, that is like nuclear war has broken out. it's a serious thing to her, and Hollywood filmmakers would never take that seriously, and he didn't have that postmodern irony. He was writing from the heart because he felt himself an outsider in high school, but he wrote about those characters, and he wrote it sincerely, and they could tell, especially Breakfast Club. And he connected to them, and he connects to them today. I think they can still look at the films and see a certain kind of honesty, whatever their flaws may be as cinema, but they detect a kind of honesty that speaks directly to them.
But in the late 80s, early 90s, there seemed to be a shift in towards the ironic teenage movie. I think of the quintessential movie that really, there was this kind of line in the sand with Heathers, which is in many ways sort of a parody or a satire of the John Hughes teenage film.
I haven't looked at Heathers in a long time. I know what you mean, though. It was I thought it was great, but it was, but that would be an adult film. I mean, it's looking at things from a very adult perspective, and although the kids dug it because they think they're adults,
right.
So it did connect with a youth audience. And I'm not saying you can't make those kinds of films and connect with youth audiences. Mean Girls is another, mm-hmm. you know, but. It wouldn't be a John Hughes kind of film, and I think they both have their place, and I think they both connect with kids. As long as you're not talking down to them, you're talking to them. I think that's the key for the filmmaker.
Do you think Hughes's films will continue to be rediscovered among future generations of film lovers, or even just regular teenagers? Will it still continue to hold up?
For the foreseeable future, I do. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball about the 22nd century, but for the foreseeable future, I don't see John Hughes going anywhere. I think people will still look at these films. The two films, there's two sets of films they'll continue looking at. One are teen films that you've identified from the 80s, but the other are the family films, the films that had sequels, like The Home Alones, like The Beethovens, and these films. They will continue, because John did something very clever. I don't know if he was thinking about it. He always built them around holidays, around Thanksgiving and Christmas. Christmas Vacation, Home Alone's at Christmas, Home Alone 2's at Christmas. Two of his films are both Dutch and Planes are Thanksgiving. He built them around holidays, so he was very aware of the fact that these would become kind of perennials. So I think they will; those films will continue. Certainly Home Alone will continue showing up forever. But, yeah, I think the family films, 101 Dalmatians, again, whatever you think of that, will be always, kids will like to see it, families will watch it with them at holidays and things. So those films will be on our TV screens or our Netflix or whatever it is in the future forever, I think. I don't think they're going away. There was a lot of films we haven't brought up that didn't do so well and have vanished. Even when I was talking to his agents, he would say, what film? Huh? No, literally, he couldn't remember career opportunities. His agent of many years, Jack Rappi, could not remember that film and looked at it and said, well, I worked on that. I don't remember it. So, I mean, you know, that film has just vanished. The only thing it did is introduce Jennifer Connelly to people. So, some films have just dropped by the wayside. But there's a handful of films, at least 10, 12 films, that are there for the long run, I think.
All right. So, like it or not, John Hughes is here to stay,
it seems. Yes, absolutely.
Puppy up. Each week, we like to highlight one piece of pop culture that we're feeling positive about. So, Gabe, why don't you start us off?
This is not a piece of pop culture, and it's not recent, but doing a little...
Is it Mozart?
No, it's not Mozart this time, but it is some old guy.
Okay.
It is The Count of Monte Cristo.
Okay.
Written by Alexandre Dumas, and it's a really good book. I really enjoy it, and... It's interesting because Alexandre Dumas was paid by the word for it, and he takes full advantage of that. His characters will be walking down the street, and they'll pass someone, you know, a woman sweeping the street, and he'll go off into 10 to 15 pages about her backstory and this and that, you know, and ultimately has no significant bearing on the story he's telling. But just kind of gets his word count up there.
Well, Charles Dickens did that too.
That's
didn't
true,
he?
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's a very good writer, and it's an enjoyable book.
All right, Kirk, how about you?
Well, I showed a film in my UCLA sneak preview class called Supermensch, Legend of Seth Gordon, and it's by Mike Myers.
Oh.
Mike Myers has made a documentary about his friend Seth Gordon, who is like this super manager who is most closely associated with Alice Cooper. And with a lot of musicians like Teddy Pendergrass and Anne Murray, oddly enough, and a whole bunch of musicians, but is one of these guys who seemingly got into the world of show business and knew and had some first encounter with everybody involved in show business. And he's a Jewish guy, but he became a Buddhist, so he's one of these Jew-boos, I think they call them. And he is supposedly retired other than handling Alice Cooper. And he has a compound in over on the beach in Maui. And he is it starts off like a Cheech and Chong movie where he's basically doing more drugs than he's doing managing, until he starts having kind of a sense of rightness and wrongness and integrity when he's dealing with people and in seeing wrong. He took over Groucho Marx pro bono when he discovered the man's finances were in disarray, and he made certain that he had a very comfortable final years of his life. For no money at all, just because he felt it was the right thing to do. And he took over some chefs who were making all this food for people and were not getting paid. And he created the celebrity chef just because he felt they were not being treated properly. Mm-hmm. And he's now into Buddhism, and he had a near-death experience while they were shooting this movie because he nearly died. He had one chance of surviving, and he survived. And it ends up being kind of this guy who's reached this spiritual epiphany where he sees things in new light, and he sees how fame is so corrosive and so bad, even though he knows it's only famous people, and he understands that it's really a terrible thing. And unfortunately, this movie might make him pretty famous because it's going to be, the Weinsteins are handling it, and it's going to be a big hit.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to seeing that. Yeah. Mine is a little show called 30 Rock.
Never heard of it.
No, yeah. Tina Fey, Alec Baldwin, sound familiar? No.
Is it a space show?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Third Rock from the Sun. Yeah. It's a spin-off of that. Yeah.
So I know what you're thinking. If I'm just now getting around to discovering 30 Rock, what am I doing with a podcast? I should probably, not contribute to the internet. Well, I'm happy to say I followed the show in its initial run, but the reason I want to endorse it now is because I had sort of given up on it towards the end, about the sixth season. I felt like something was missing. The beats just didn't hit quite the same way they did in the earlier seasons. But I've recently gone back and rewatched the whole thing, and turns out that a less than stellar season of 30 Rock is still better.
About 90% of what's on.
Exactly. So, there's a lot of really delightful things that happen in the seventh season. And the characters do end up growing up a little bit, but they end up growing up in very absurd ways.
But when you say you went back and rewatched it, you went back and rewatched the entire series?
The entire series, yes.
That's quite an accomplishment.
I think so. Yeah, I wanted my final note of positivity to be a book because lately I've been doing a lot of television shows. But as I finished up the book, I'm like, well, I don't know if I really want to talk about this.
So, can you mention the book, or are we not going to mention the book?
Well, it's Where'd You Go, Bernadette, but it was good. You could also check that one out. That one's okay. It's one of the author was a writer on Arrested Development, and she wrote this strange book. But I didn't feel like it quite lived up to the high standards that we keep here for our final notes of positivity. So instead, I want to endorse the sixth and seventh seasons of 30 Rock. And so basically what I'm saying is that sometimes loyalty pays off. And on that note, here's to sticking things out to the end. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Let us know what you think of Breathless and all the other topics we discussed today on our show page, flickswise.com. You can also reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. Follow us on Twitter at FlixWise. But the most important thing, subscribe in iTunes. And please, please, please rate us and maybe even leave us a comment. It will really help us stand out in the iTunes database if we get lots of ratings and comments. And join us next time for a journey through the heart of darkness as we discuss the 14th greatest film of all time, Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. And we may also... Prior to that, we may also have another addition to the alternate list. We'll see. Keeping you on your toes here. But until then, Kirk, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And listeners can expect your book to be on store shelves around the 30th anniversary of The Breakfast Club. Is that correct?
It'll be out sometime early next year, they tell me.
Okay. And you'll have to keep us posted on your progress.
Yes.
Do you want to give a shout out?
Oh, I suppose I'm supposed to do things like that. Honeycutthollywood.com.
All right. Listeners can check out his reviews. Obviously, really insightful, really great resource. So, and Gabe, as always.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for tuning in, guys. Yours truly, the FlixWise Club.